Miracle on the second advent.
This is a book that one of Prabhupada's first disciples, Mukunda Goswami, wrote about his experiences with Prabhupada in the beginning. It's there. They have arrived in London now. Him and his wife and two other married couples. They went to London in 1968 to start a temple there. The place was full of people milling around the front counter and reading the large bulletin board that held the announcements of gigs, gatherings, and other events in the city. Someone was selling pottery and someone else was giving a demonstration of some kind of New Age therapy. There was a bookstall where people talked together and passed joints around. The air smelled musty like cigarette smoke, incense, pot, and feet. The patrons looked pretty much like the alternatives in San Francisco, and they loved the chanting. Even if they seemed a bit more reserved than their American brothers and sisters. On our first night there, Jim and Jack let us chant in the main hall, which was about half the size of a basketball court. There were lots of happy faces and people singing along that night, and several even took off their shoes and danced on the carpeted floor. They came to London right after they had been in San Francisco for a year or so. They started a temple in San Francisco in the summer of love, 1967, and then this is like the next year. They had started a really successful temple in San Francisco. Our Arts Lab programs became a regular thing. Our primary venue through which to get in touch with the British public. Three times a week we drove into the city and chanted with about 100 people. After the first couple of weeks, the novelty of the programs wore off, and Jim and Jack relegated us to the smaller room upstairs, which was painted all black and was used as the lab's theater. It was always covered in cigarette butts that we had to sweep up before each chanting session. We wrote to the Swami to inform him about our programs, hoping that he would respond positively. We knew our primary objective in London was to open a temple, but we were quickly realizing that things were different here than in America. The Swami responded promptly to our letters, and when each letter arrived from him, the person to whom it was addressed read it aloud for everyone to hear. This is giving me so much pleasure to hear how nicely you are carrying on this movement in London, Malati read out loud in September. It was originally my Guru Maharaj's desire that there should be a center established in London. And by his mercy, now you have successfully begun this mission. So please keep me informed how you are progressing there. I am very anxious to hear in each letter. You all three couples are expert in the matter of preaching Krishna consciousness. So I am sure by your combined effort in London, there will be a great successful center. The matter of the center was always on our minds, but getting one started was a question of money and contact. The Swami wrote with some practical suggestions about how we could increase both. Why don't you get back to Godhead from New York, he suggested. Here in New York, they are selling an average of 100 copies of Back to Godhead each day. So try to get immediately copies of Back to Godhead from New York and try to sell them in large quantities. That is our backbone. Kirtan plus distribution of books and literature is the basic principle of our success. Here was a confirmation from the Swami about how to spread his movement in London. Distribution of spiritual literature and public chanting. And so it came to pass one cold and overcast morning that the six of us in Saraswati donned our best Vaishnava clothing, piled into the Ford pickup, and headed out to have our first chant in the streets of London. We decided to try Trafalgar Square first. It was always packed with tourists, and we thought that the statue of Lord Nelson atop his 100-foot perch would be a fitting witness to our first public chanting foray in London. We parked the truck and filed into the square, cold and nervous, but exhilarated. Our colorful clothing a stark contrast to the gray of the square. I started to play our only mridanga while the others played their kartals. The pigeons strutting about scavenging for the crumbs took flight instantly at the sound of the cymbals. Our voices and instruments resounded around the sprawling cement plaza, attracting an immediate response. A crowd of tourists, shoppers, and business people began to form around us. Some tapped their feet and smiled, but most stood statuesque in disbelief. To muster up courage, I pretended the Swami was there in the crowd watching us. Cars, lorries, taxis, and bright red buses careened past us on four sides, and the square's fountains spewed water. But to anyone close enough, our chanting drowned out every other sound. The traffic, the warbling of the birds, and the spray of water cascading into the pools that surrounded the fountains. Nelson must get bored up there sometimes, I thought, as we began to sway in synchrony. This will liven up his day. Gazing up at the larger-than-life statue of the Admiral standing regally on top of his column, I felt my apprehensions scatter like the flock of pigeons had a few minutes earlier. That is, until I started to notice the startled eyes of the uniformed police who had begun to gather on the periphery of the crowd. I thought maybe I was being paranoid, but there did seem to be an awful lot of them, maybe 30 or more. They formed a little clutch about 10 yards from the crowd. They huddled together and kept glancing back at us as if developing some sort of strategy. Surely they can't arrest us, I thought. We have Saraswati with us, and anyway, we're not doing anything wrong. We're just enjoying ourselves and giving the lunchtime crowd some entertainment. I don't see how they can think there's anything wrong with that. On the other hand, they might think we've been taking drugs and that we're carrying acid. The crowd had grown to nearly 100, and I realized that we should have made a leaflet to explain who we were and what we were doing. I kept chanting, pounding my mridanga. Finally, one of the bobbies emerged from their conference. He strode purposefully toward the center of the crowd and waited until I wasn't singing, and the other five were responding to my lead. I tried to appear calm, but inside I felt shivery and my heart was thumping. Panic was setting in. My traumatic encounter with the police in Hurleyville was still fresh in my memory. "May I speak to your leader, please?" He pitched his words carefully, his voice authoritative and loud. I relaxed immediately. "He's gently inquisitive," I thought. "How quaint." I'd expected an American response. "You guys gotta get out of here right now. Or worse, we're gonna search your bags." I kept playing my mridanga, but a bit softer. I felt the crowd close in ever so slightly, their eyes sparkling with curiosity. A derelict carrying a big black sack staggered by a few feet in front of us, and the policeman was momentarily distracted. "You can speak with me if you like," I said over the sound of my mridanga. I'll leave it there for today.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Chapter 4, chapter 29, verse number 49. Asteria darvai prad agrai Katsnena kshitri mandalam Sattva brihat vadan mani Karma paishi yat param Karma haritosham yat Sadityatam materiaya
Sadityatam materiaya
Asteria darvai pradagrai
Asteria darvai pradagrai
Harchnyena kshitimangalam
Harchnyena kshitimangalam
Stabdho brihat vadan mani
Stabdho brihat vadan mani
Karmana vaishiyat param
Karmana vaishiyat param
Karma haritosham yat
Karma haritosham yat
Sadidhyam tanmatir jaya
Sadidhyam tanmatir jaya
Covered with the sharp points of Kusha grass, and on the strength of this you have become proud because you have killed various types of animals and sacrifices. Because of your foolishness, you do not know that devotional service is the only way one can please the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You cannot understand this fact. Your only activities should be those that can please the Supreme, the Personality of Godhead. Our education should be such that we can become elevated to Krishna consciousness. Perfect. In this verse, the great sage Narada Muni directly insults the king because he was engaged in performing sacrifices that entailed the killing of a great number of animals. The king was thinking that he was great for having performed so many sacrifices, but the great sage Narada directly chastises him, informing him that his animal killing only leads to his being puffed up with false prestige. Actually, anything that is done which does not lead to Krishna consciousness is a sinful activity. And any education that does not lead one to understand Krishna is false education. If Krishna consciousness is missing, one is simply engaged in false activities and false educational pursuits. Om Yantam Randasya Nantana Swataya Chakshu Unmuli Kamina Tasmaya Shikravina. So, Prabhupada says that Narada Muni is in the role of the spiritual master of the king, and he chastised and called him a fool. Prabhupada says he directly insults the king because he was engaged in performing sacrifice. Krishna started his preaching in Bhagavad Gita sort of the same way. He said, while speaking learned words, you are lamenting for that which is not worthy of grief. And Prabhupada says that Krishna was calling Arjuna a fool. Of course, Arjuna is not a fool. Arjuna is an eternal associate, intimate associate of Krishna, and he's the greatest human being. He comes with Krishna everywhere he goes. So he's not a fool, but I told this one last night in the class, but Prabhupada gives the analogy of how Krishna instructs us. One analogy that he gave is that a mother instructs her daughter-in-law by instructing her daughter. And the daughter-in-law and the son come to live in the mother and father's house, and mother doesn't want to instruct the daughter-in-law directly because, you know, she might be rebellious, she not want to listen to the mother-in-law, and she has her own false ego. And so the mother-in-law instructs her by instructing her daughter. The daughter doesn't need the instruction. She's heard, and her mother has told her the same thing before, but she's hoping that the daughter-in-law will hear her talking to her daughter and take it in that way. So Arjuna doesn't need the instruction from Krishna, but we do. All the conditioned souls in the material world do. So that's the method of instruction. Of course, in this case, King Krishnavari, he needed the instruction. He wasn't in the position of Arjuna as a constant companion of Krishna, but he was in the role of a submissive disciple taking instructions from his spiritual master. Greatest spiritual master you can find is Narada Muni himself. So Narada Muni insulted him. He said, you think you're doing so good, you think you're so great, you're doing all these Vedic rituals and sacrifices. And they're bona fide rituals and sacrifices. It's not like they weren't, like he was doing something wild or crazy or something that was irreligious or un-Vedic. But he was doing these sacrifices, they're bona fide things. But Narada Muni is criticizing him. He says that, insulting him. So, we all in that position. We come to Krishna consciousness, and as soon as we come, we start hearing things that are like really hard to hear. And you're a fool, you're a rascal, you're a fallen soul, you're envious of Krishna, you're puffed up, you're, you know, we hear all these things like right away from the beginning, as soon as we start reading the Bhagavad Gita and hearing from Prabhupada or Prabhupada's disciples. I remember when I got the day I got initiated in New York, we went to the New York Pratyatra, and when it came back, there was a party of like four or five of us that went down there, and we drove back after the initiation ceremony. And we came in the back door by the kitchen, and the head cook was in there cooking. And I worked in the kitchen a lot, and me and him were, he was my direct authority. He was always telling me what to do. He's a senior devotee. At that time, 5 years was senior devotee. And he was a really good devotee. And they had heard from, on the telephone, what our names were, what our initiated names were. And I walked in back door and go in the kitchen, and he goes, "Ah, Muktavandir, great soul." And I was, he was saying, "Oh," and I was saying, "Yes, well, I could, you've understood my position, actually, that I'm a great soul." But all he was saying was you're initiated by Prabhupada. You're in the disciplic succession from Krishna himself. You're a great soul. You're taking part in the process of Krishna consciousness. But I was thinking, yes, he's seen how great I am. And then he could see the look on my face. He could see that, this guy's really puffed up. And he said, "Now get upstairs and take a shower and get down here and wash the pots." So I said, "Okay, I'm a great soul, I better go wash the pots." So we have to hear these real, we have to hear hard things. We have to hear the criticism and insult even. If somebody's going to, Prabhupada uses the word insult here, it's used in a very specific context by Narada Muni in relationship to his disciple. And Narada Muni is a great spiritual master, so you can't take that and say, in the beginning of the movement there was a lot of that, like chastisement and overly heavy a lot of times. And it was because everyone was young and immature, and they were proud of being devotees and being Brahmins or being temple president or being sannyasi or GBC. So they would be like, "I'm going to chastise this person." And chastisements are in order. There's letters from Prabhupada where he says you have to, there are times, I can't quote directly, but there are times you have to chastise and correct the disciples. That a person is not your disciple, is my disciple, but you're his authority. So there are times you have to chastise. So it's not like they were doing, or are doing today. It's not like that never happens anymore. But it's not like they were doing something like completely unauthorized. But they, because of youth and immaturity and overzealousness and some puffed up mentality, they could do it and carry it too far and do it improperly. But I would say generally, at least in my experience, that sometimes we get chastised by Niranjana Swami or by temple commander or the head of the kitchen, and I would be chastised fairly regularly and deservedly so. And I knew that they were doing it in a Krishna conscious way. They're trying to do it in something that would help me become a better devotee. And it did. I learned a lot. You learn a lot from being chastised. The first thing I learned about being chastised by a senior devotee or authority is, as soon as you realize, generally, devotees would talk to each other and they would just talk and I would talk, and I knew that they were an older devotee, but I was respectful. that we had taught. But as soon as I knew, I could perceive, and it's not hard to perceive, as soon as I could perceive that, oh, I'm getting chastised. This is not a conversation, this is a one-way conversation. And as soon as I could perceive that, the best thing to do is just shut up and listen and just take it, because we need it. We're conditioned souls. We need to hear hard things. And we benefit by them. Even if it's done improperly, if we take it in a humble way, in a submissive spirit, in a humble way, we still benefit by accepting a chastisement in the proper mood. So that's another thing I learned. And I know that there was one devotee named Srinath, and he's a really good devotee. And he was another older devotee who took me under his wing when we didn't have a bhakti program at the time, but he was like he wasn't my authority. I was working in the kitchen and stuff, but he was like my unofficial bhakti leader. And he was really nice and really good devotee. But he could be a little heavy too. And sometimes I wasn't dressed exactly properly. Sometimes I wore like a t-shirt with a hole in it. So a couple of times, I remember one time, right after the morning program, I was up in the second floor hall after prasadam, and he called me over, and he was sitting down. He's a lot taller than me. He was sitting down, and I came over to him. He stuck his finger in the hole in my t-shirt and ripped it all the way down. I just said, oh, okay, I better go put on a better t-shirt. It's not like, oh, how dare he? He tore my t-shirt. This is intolerable. But that would be an improper reaction. The proper reaction is just take it humbly and just go put on a better shirt. And you can learn from that. You can learn a lot from that. And Prabhupada says here that, the king was thinking that he was great for having performed so many sacrifices, but the great sage Narada directly chastises him, informing him that his animal killing only leads to his being puffed up with false prestige. Actually, anything that is done which does not lead to Krishna consciousness is a sinful activity. The Prabhupada even calling the Vedic sacrifices that he was doing, calling them sinful activities. Which is, it's a sinful activity, but it's Vedic. It's a Vedic sacrifice. But it wasn't leading him to surrender to Krishna, which is the goal of the Vedas. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, the compiler of the Vedas, the knower of the Vedanta, it's me that is to be known. So anything that's done up to and including Vedic sacrifices which don't encourage one or lead one to surrender to Krishna, Prabhupada called various things, like a waste of time, or in this place, a sinful activity. That's how rare Krishna consciousness is. That's how important Krishna consciousness is. That nothing else, everything else is considered only so much wasted time, useless waste of time, if it doesn't have anything to do with Krishna consciousness and helps us become better devotees. And any education that does not lead one to understand Krishna is false education. If Krishna consciousness is missing, one is simply engaged in false activities and false educational pursuits. Like early in the movement, like if somebody was in college or sometimes even high school, devotees would say, you can just quit college and come move in the temple and chant Hare Krishna. And a lot of devotees did that. And now it's like, and they liked it. And we had one devotee, Mancharesh, he's in Florida. He was a Harvard student in 1970. And he left Harvard to come over and move in the temple, North Beacon Street. And very intelligent, very learned, scholarly devotee. That was sort of not unusual at all. Now our preaching is pretty much like if somebody's in college, it's like, you should stay in college, finish college, get your education. But, there are some devotees still who are ready to just chuck it off and just say, heck with it. I'm going to the temple. I want to be a devotee. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. If somebody wants to do that, then all glories to them. But generally, we don't preach like that these days. But we should never be under the illusion that their college education is necessary for Krishna consciousness. Certainly not necessary to be a devotee. And it's not in and of itself the education, even if it's Harvard or MIT, big shot scholar, even the top school, if it's not doesn't have anything to do with Krishna consciousness, it's just it's no better than the guy digging the trench in the street and doing it's no more value than that. We shouldn't be in that illusion. If Krishna consciousness is missing, one is simply engaged in false activities and false educational pursuits. There's a couple more statements. One by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Getting a lot of education, reading many books, just makes one more foolish than an ass. And that's a good one. And then the statements by Prabhupada that I'm just speaking in old style. We don't really talk like this very much anymore. But it's still valid instruction. It's not like it's outdated or anything. Just because it's not the present mode of preaching. The Prabhupada's devotees like Jadarani, I think, was asked Prabhupada. She was a painter in the beginning of 26th Second Avenue. I think it was her. And she wanted to go to art school and learn to be a better painter. And Prabhupada, he said, no, you don't go to school. You'll go to school and you'll learn all these fancy things. And you're already painting pictures of Krishna. Just keep painting pictures of Krishna, and he'll give you all the intelligence and ability necessary to become a great artist. And the early devotees who were relatively crude, like this painting here, it's an old painting, but some of these other ones, you could say relatively crude, but beautiful in its own right. And the devotees who painted that 50 years ago are now they're painting like unbelievable stuff, right? And this is unbelievable too. But they're painting like incredible stuff. And just because they were always painting pictures of Krishna, and Krishna gave them the intelligence and the ability. Krishna says, I'm the ability in man. So Prabhupada, a lot of times he would recommend like that, of course, you don't have to go to college to finish any education. Just take whatever you know right now and use it in Krishna's service. Whatever you need to know, Krishna will give you that. Of course, if it's a very special thing that has to be learned, then the devotee has to take instruction in this or that. Or devotees want to become expert in Sanskrit, sometimes they go to college, and that's good. or Prabhupada had the Bhaktivedanta Institute in the beginning, which he was comprised of doctorate holders in education in different scientific fields. And Prabhupada wanted that, so that he liked that, but that they could go and preach in educated circles where they would only accept someone who has a PhD after his name to preach. So it's not like it's an absolute, but his general instruction was just take whatever you know right now. You can, whatever you know, you can use it fully in Krishna's service, and that will be sufficient. Okay, stop there. Any questions or comments? Yes?
It's a comment, because like when you were talking about the vicious ties, I just want to share my experience. Like, I think the first 10 years of my practice of Krishna consciousness, I would never get offended by Vinci Stash, and I just analyzed them why. Because I was always thinking, I'm just nothing. Like, I'm like the all devotees around me are senior to me.
Yeah.
So when you think this way, it's like naturally humble.
Right.
And so whatever they say, even sometimes I wouldn't understand what they mean, like why they just tied me, but I didn't get offended by them because I was thinking they're senior, they're right. I must be just nothing. Mm-hmm. And just after 10 years, something maybe I started think that I a little bit become advanced. Sometimes I think that maybe these devotees are not as advanced as me, so I think that now like they cannot judge me. So
yeah.
Thank you. It's just because you mentioned that point, and I decided to analyze what is going on, and just so. But we cannot also imitate. I cannot imitate now and say, okay, I'm humble as a grass. If I don't feel like this, I should just try to like, meditate and become humble.
If your spirit, if Naranjana Swami comes and chastises it, you'll be very humble and happy. So, and that's a benediction. Early in the movement, especially older devotee was that principle was really heavily emphasized. If there was two devotees, somebody come to the temple, a nice person that was wanted to hear something about Krishna, and if there was a younger devotee and an older devotee there. And like I said, the difference wasn't much. It could be a year, or 6 months, or like 2, 3, 5 years. Not a big difference in time and devotional service. But the younger devotee wasn't supposed to preach to the person in the presence of the older devotee. And he was supposed to defer to the older devotee. Like, there was an older devotee here, he should talk to you, or she should talk to you. And then that was very common, a standard mode of behavior. And it's good because it helps us become humble. It's a good thing. And it's Vaishnava etiquette. It's standard Vaishnava behavior. Anything else? Questions or comments? Because we can't live in fear or anxiety, but we should be Krishna consciousness, like in the United States, and I grew up in the United States, and you're not taught a lot of respect in the United States, even when I grew up like 50 years ago. And now, especially nowadays, it's like respect, it's like what does that mean? Like people walk down the sidewalk, they walk down the street and on Boylston Street or something, and you're walking along, and somebody is walking towards you, and you can tell by the way they're walking that they're not going to walk to step aside. They're not going to move like an inch to let you go by. They're going to keep walking, and especially if they're bigger than you. You better move aside unless you want to fight or get run over. I mean, a lot of times it's young. I mean, it's just like respect in this day and age is almost a forgotten concept. But it's a really important concept in Krishna consciousness.
You said like you live in field because this is like material consciousness. Like I am stronger, so I'm right. Yes, so, and then the state of the devotees, you should not fear when you try to overcome. We should what? When you try all the devotees, when there is no fear because you are not fearing that somebody will try to. Yeah, because we're all in it together.
It's not me against anybody. It's me. It's me with everybody, fighting Maya side by side, conquering illusion, and going back to Godhead. That's how it's supposed to be.
So as you think that if, like, I feel fear, that means something wrong is with my Krishna consciousness. Because usually the tendency is to think that something wrong is with people around me. I guess the right thing is to think that maybe I do something wrong.
That's a humble attitude. When Bhaktivedanta Swami, he spent a lot of time in Gita Nagari for several years, and he had quite a few disciples there. And he had like four principles printed out on a card, and they'd put up. I have it up in my room. And one of how devotees should get along with each other. And one of his principles that he wrote down, it's really, and I like it a lot, is that any time there's a problem between me and another devotee, I should take it, he tells specifically between devotees, any time there's a problem, I should take it that it's my fault, or it's at least half my fault. And anyway, if I do anything to retaliate, even if it's not my fault, first of all, we should assume that it is. But even if it's not, if we retaliate, we're just going to make the situation worse. So, Krishna conscious attitude is to always, you know, as far as possible, always take the humble position.
It's also because Srila Prabhupada said, you will show me your love or you will cooperate. That's right. It could be like fault, not fault, but the fault that I don't want to cooperate. I could be wrong, but that's like... I'm getting, so thank you, because of your lecture I'm getting this realization, so I want to share that. I'm not going to act like that, but I would love to. Yeah, okay. I might not agree with you, you have your way, I have my way, but all right, it's not like your way is bad, my way is perfect.
Your way is pretty good, let's do it, I mean, with more, if we can be like that, it just makes everything more go more smoothly, and we're supposed to make things go smoothly.
Okay, I'll go to the public. Now, we should have Krishna prepared.